What happens when a video game composer wants to write, record, and perform a symphony with like a full orchestra, choir, and synthesizers? Welcome to a special episode of Top Score from Classical Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Emily Reese. I say special episode because we aren't talking about a game this time on Top Score. But anyone with a finger on the pulse of video game music is familiar with the name Jeremy Soule. Composer Jeremy Soule most recently wrote the score to The Elder Scrolls V: Skyrim, as well as Guild Wars 2. But his next project will take him to the stage. Jeremy is using the project funding site Kickstarter to fund the writing, recording, printing, and performance of his very first symphony. And he's calling it Symphony No. 1, The Northerner. He's still working hard on The Northerner, but was kind enough to provide samples of the piece. That will be the first music we'll hear. For the rest of the episode, we'll hear music from some of the 36 games he's scored over the span of his career, including the Harry Potter games, the Elder Scrolls series, Secret of Evermore, Company of Heroes, SOCOM, and more. Tell me about your symphony and the Kickstarter campaign.
Well, the Kickstarter was really a giant experiment. We didn't know what would happen, to be honest with you, because it's Kickstarter and it's really kind of new. And the symphony as a format is not, you know, the most popular form of music.
Right.
And you know what I mean? It's not like I was, you know, Kickstarting a hip-hop record or something. It was, you know, something way kind of out there. And I didn't know, too, really if, you know, my fans would find me on Kickstarter. Seems like a lot of them did.
Yes.
I really did think about it for a long time in terms of whether or not I was going to go this direction and do a Kickstarter. You know, because I could have, for all practical purposes, just created the symphony, recorded it, and released it, you know, without going through this process. But I felt like, financial considerations aside, because the whole point of Kickstarter is really, you know, to help jumpstart or kickstart ideas that normally, you know, I couldn't go down to a bank and say, hey, I would like for you guys to loan me money. Or I'd go to an investor and say, hey, invest in my symphony. People look at me like I'm strange. But I think this is why the general public having the ability to work with creative ideas is a great thing, because essentially I think the masses can see things that the few don't. And they always talk about, you know, if you're really into geek culture, and I kind of am, you'll read about Kurzweil and singularity, and you'll read about collective intelligence and all these different concepts. And how that directly relates to Kickstarter, I'm not sure. But I thought a long time about it. But the real reason I decided to go forward was the interaction I would have with the fans, and also people who may not know my music,
right,
and maybe found me through the Kickstarter platform or through some of the news articles or, well, radio interviews for that matter.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been great, and it's really made me better, because I've had to really consider a lot of questions and a lot of creativity coming in as what. I mean, just coming to the concept, like, what does the Northerner mean to my listeners? Back in the old days, they used to have subtitles and whatnot to kind of add a little color or meaning to the, like, you know, Moonlight Sonata. Well, Beethoven didn't actually name Moonlight Sonata Moonlight Sonata. That was done by his publisher.
Yep.
But in this case, The Northerner was my name. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to explore a really big concept and something that anyone could participate in. And something about the top of the world and the North Pole and, mm-hmm. you know, Aurora Borealis and sort of the, I guess, the mystique of adventure just sort of rang a note with me. And I think with a symphony, you have to pick a bigger palette to mm-hmm. work with.
Symphony is an incredibly difficult thing for a composer to do. I mean, this is well documented throughout music history. Even someone like Brahms, it took him years and years and years to even finish his first one. So what do you think it is that is so, it's just like barely out of reach for composers about writing a symphony?
Well, first and foremost, unless you're Charles Ives and you're selling insurance and Leonard Bernstein comes along and discovers you.
Yeah.
You know, it's time consuming. And, mm-hmm. you know, you have to have means to be able to spend that kind of time, you know, on a symphony. And unless you just want to crank them out and you're brilliant like Haydn, he could just, you know, almost instantaneously print out. He had like a symphony printer.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it just... He had this mysterious machine that he never showed anyone, and all these brilliant symphonies came out. So, no, I think that's the one thing about the symphony is, you know, you analyze them in college as a composer. You know, if you mm-hmm. go the college route, and you learn how intricate they are, and I think you learn sort of the backstory as well, mm-hmm. and you learn that there was a lot of criticism a lot of times of some of the great works. Why is the symphony so difficult? I think it's a number of things at work. One is just the intimidation factor. Mm-hmm. You know, and to write a symphony, I think you have to have a fair amount of knowledge, and you're educated to do it for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
So you do run into these stories just in the course of study. And I think the second thing is the amount of time mm-hmm. required.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, take some means to be able to do it. And the third thing is I think what discourages a lot of composers from maybe committing to a work like this is feeling like it'll never be performed within their lifetime.
Right.
I think this is huge. And I've been very lucky because a lot of my work I've been able to realize because of digital technology. And then, you know, I would say 90% of the time I'm working in synthesizers and 10% of the time I'm working with live orchestras. It's not every day that you get a chance to work with the London Philharmonia or, yeah. you know, the Seattle Symphony or Prague Philharmonic or, I mean,
yep.
And I've had opportunity to work with these kinds of groups, but it happens every few years. And I think a lot of it has to do with the nature of the projects that I do.
Yes.
You know, we need a lot of music and video games. We need hours and hours and hours and hours in some of these games. My last two projects were over 4 hours of music each.
Yeah.
Well over 4 hours. So we're talking 8 hours of music between Skyrim, it was called Elder Scrolls V,
mm-hmm.
Skyrim, and then Guild Wars 2, which mm-hmm. was an online video game.
Mm-hmm.
To record all that music with a live orchestra is ginormously expensive.
Yes.
And the nature of design is such that, you know, creators like to come in and change game designs, and they like to manipulate scenes. And
mm-hmm.
and so when you record music with an orchestra, it's like pouring cement. It's going to dry.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to make a change, you have to hire the orchestra to come back in.
Yeah.
And that means you have to rip the sidewalk up and re-pour the cement. So in a creative world like video games where you need a lot of flexibility, it does lend itself to digital technologies and synthesizers and samplers and physical modeled instruments. And that's where we are right now in music.
Samples have improved so much, too. I mean, it's not... I mean, I think you and I would both agree that in a perfect world, we'd always have the actual instrumentalists there. But samples sound so good now that there are times that I have trouble distinguishing the difference. And, I mean, I hear a lot of audio every single day.
Absolutely. I mean, you have trained ears. And, you know, I it kind of dawned on me when... a concertmaster that I know in an orchestra, he asked me who my piano tuner was on a particular CD that I'd put together, and I kind of had a chuckle because that was not a real piano. That was a sampled piano.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had this arms race going on in the digital instrument arena, and it's been kind of amusing to follow and kind of exciting too, but you know, one sample library says, well, we have 1 million samples in our library. And another library says, ah, we got 10 million samples in our library. And,
yeah.
You know, and the musicians, you know, albeit they don't have, I think, the means to hire orchestras all the time. I certainly don't. But, you know, these tools themselves can add up and they can be quite expensive. And so the one thing I will say is that, you know, in some ways, digital technology is a blessing because, you know, we were able to render things at less than $10,000 an hour. Because that's what you're burning in London.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the other hand, it is a bit of an arms race and there's a steep learning curve. And yes, it's gotten a lot better, but I always find that, you know, I can spend all day playing with toys and tools and not actually get any music done.
Now, you had an original goal for your Kickstarter campaign that was $10,000. And am I correct that the stretch goal, one of the goals, as it were, of the stretch goal is to have a full orchestra? Can you talk just a little bit more about that?
Well, yes. I'm still using synthesizers, even at $100,000, because to really, I mean, and the veterans of the business, I mean, they probably looked at my $10,000 figure and they said, Jeremy's crazy, because they know how much this stuff costs, and especially when you get into a choral symphony like what I'm writing. But, you know, I didn't want money to be the obstacle to make this real. And, you know, if I had to have relied on computers at the $10,000 level and just brought in soloists, you know, to sweeten things, like maybe a concertmaster or a solo soprano or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I would have made something beautiful with that.
Yes.
I know I could. Well, I don't want to say, well, look at me and my zealous confidence, but you know, I've done work that people have really liked, and I've done it with almost no money.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible. And of course, I'm not paying myself. I'm just covering the musician costs. The stretch goal, you know, when we met our goal in basically 24 hours of 10, I didn't think we'd make it much past that for the entire month, to be honest with you. I would have been happy to be, you know, one of the more normal Kickstarter music projects, because there are a lot of projects up there. And, you know, it's quite common for a project to earn between $5,000 and $10,000.
Okay.
And I didn't really think that, you know, I would be any different. I mean, you have to assume that. And, you know, I know there's a few projects up there that have done, you know, there's like one project that's done over $1 million, and there's some projects up there that have done hundreds of thousands. And I think in those cases, you know, maybe those people have a really great connection with their fan base.
Yeah.
And sort of a pre-installed fan base. And they'd sort of have been working in a direct consumer relationship for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas with me, I'm part of something else. My music goes into a video game, but I'm not the product, you know? I mean, so for people to make the association that, hey, maybe we want to hear more music like what Jeremy Soule does, but not in the context of a video game, that was a bit of a question mark, you know?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I'd like to think that, you know, what I do is appreciated, and certainly a lot of people, you know, they say wonderful things, and you know, I have my critics too, but I'm encouraged a lot by the reviews that we get for these games, and of course, the games have been, some of them have been phenomenally successful. I can't even count the numbers now. I mean, to really think that over 60 million people here have heard my music, and they've spent hours and hours and hours with it.
Right. Yeah, they're on their fourth playthrough of Skyrim.
And by this point, they don't hate me. I mean, that's actually probably a good thing.
One of the things that I think about often when I hear your music, especially if I'm listening to it independently of the game, I'm not playing a game that Jeremy Soule has scored, I'm just listening to your music. One of the things I notice is, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but how melodic it is, because I think a lot of times one of the challenges in writing game music is, you know, try not to be too melodic because it's going to loop and loop and loop and we'll get sick of it. But that never seems to be an issue with what you write.
Well, that's a very acute observation you have there. And you know, the thing for me is, and this is a challenge with every video game score, is you really have to understand direction. And, you know, if you have too much of a climb or not enough of a climb, you're in trouble, because too much of a climb, you're going to hear a loop.
Yes.
And not enough of a climb, they're going to get bored. So you have to be aware of, I guess, how wear-ready the music is. I mean, in other words, you start with this pair of jeans. They're like almost black. They're so navy blue, and they're like cardboard. And then you have to imagine what those jeans would be like going through, you know, that aging process that they do, you know, to get them ready to sell at Barney's for, you know, way too much money.
Yeah.
But, you know, you really have to understand, I guess you have to think about, what is this song going to feel like once it's heard for the 20th time or the 30th time?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the irony in all this is that we have something in the music industry, because I also have done work in the music industry, called windshield time. And windshield time is the best time when we can get people to listen to music because they have their radios on, they're commuting.
Yep.
And one of the things that's employed, and you being in the radio business probably aware of this term, it's called heavy rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think ubiquity and popularity are two different things.
Yes.
And certainly, you know, you create ubiquity for a lot of pop stars to induce popularity. And there's a theory that the more someone hears a piece of music, the odds are they're going to like it or they're really going to hate it.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you know, we get more acclimated to it. And there's something about a song being familiar that makes it pleasing. And I guess where I'm going with this is that in some ways in video games, we have heavy rotation from hell. So, and I've seen composers come into this business, do a game, and never get hired again. I mean, I've seen it happen because they get such a visceral response from the fans. Because, you know, right now, you have about 48 hours before the word's in on your game. And, you know, I've seen it. I've seen where the fans are like, oh, this music's terrible. You know, I had shut it off right away. And And, you know, I almost feel like in some ways that was an advantage for me, because when I came into the games industry, there wasn't a lot of high expectation for what music could be.
Right, yeah.
You know, we were just coming out of the Nintendo era, and you know, Koji Kondo wrote some really wickedly catchy tunes, but they were coming off 8-bit audio process. And, you know, as charming as that can be for some people, for other people, they just hear it as boops and beeps and something very crude. There's no real expression in there. And so when I came in the business in 94, I was sort of envisioning the time that when we'd get CD-ROM, because that was sort of on the horizon at that time, that there might be a possibility that we could actually have an expressive ensemble perform music for a video game. And that was what was mind-blowing for me. And to think that what would a game experience be like, and how would it be heightened if we had this music?
So with your Kickstarter, you're going to hopefully be able to record this in some seriously high-quality sound. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I mean,
because I don't think people understand what they're missing. Like you said in one of your updates, you know, you don't know what you're missing when you're listening to music from iTunes. Nothing against iTunes, but the delivery method for a sound file is much easier if it's a smaller file. So.
You know, oh, absolutely. Yeah. We deal with compression audio. It's great you brought that up. We deal with compression audio formats, and we cheat a lot in the video game business to get all of that data squeezed into a certain space. Mm-hmm. And usually, you know, the audio has gotten better in the years in video games. But most games are using some form of audio compression like MP3 or OGG. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't seen a video game yet that ships with lossless audio compression. Maybe there are some, but I haven't worked on any. And the Northern Air campaign, one of the things we've done is we've offered anyone who pledges at the $15 tier, we're sending them a CD. It's an autographed CD. I'm autographing every single CD that's going out because I appreciate my fans so much. What we're doing with the Northerners, we're actually distributing 24-bit 96 kilohertz files.
Man.
And
that's insane.
It's nice. It's, you know, a CD is, for those that aren't so technical, a CD uses an audio format called 16-bit 44.1. Mm-hmm. So a 16-bit would be like the amount of cylinders you have in the engine. So you have 16 cylinders. Running 44.1 would be like 44 miles an hour .1. Whereas 24 would be a 24-cylinder engine running at 96 miles an hour. And the thing about it is speed. It's like if you're trying to capture a hummingbird and his wings are moving really quickly, you're going to want a high-speed camera to capture, you know, the essence of that hummingbird. If you have a slower camera or a lower-resolution camera, you're going to have a blob in front of you. But a high-speed, ultra-high-resolution camera, you're going to have something remarkable to look at. And audio is really that way. And I think one of the reasons the music industry has gone through a little bit of doldrum is because audio quality has suffered so much in the iPod generation.
Yeah.
I'm not, shy to say it, but those Apple earbuds are terrible. They're awful. There are whole generations that, you know, have really entered their teenage years and have sort of grown up with these. And, you know, even the output circuitry on an iPod isn't very good when you put it up against hi-fi equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of people would laugh at grandpa's vinyl records. But, you know, a vinyl record can produce up to 30 kilohertz, which is far higher than a CD can produce, let alone an MP3. things are going to higher resolution places. We're going to, you know, more precision, the way we do our animations and the way we do our motion capture. And, you know, if you've seen anything going on in a Hollywood film in the last 5 years, there's not one video game on Earth that's not using the same technology. You know, they've got the same rendering programs in the background. In fact, it's, you could take someone who'd work at, like, you know, an Industrial Light and Magic, and they could work at Electronic Arts. You know, there's, yeah, it's the careers are really becoming interchangeable. Mm-hmm. But I digress for a minute. I just wanted to say that we wanted to provide a new experience, a high-resolution experience, because we want people to hear how this music can breathe and how emotional it is. I also want to say, too, that, you know, music is one of the great inductors of emotion. I mean, if you allow yourself to be affected by music, you'll find that your mood changes quite quickly, depending on what the piece of music is. And that really is the power of music. And one of the primary reasons this happens is because of harmonic modulation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being the geek side of me, I love science. In fact, you know, my grandfather was a scientist, and, you know, my father was a music teacher. And mm-hmm. when I used to go to Grandpa's house, he had soldering guns, and he would solder things together, whether they would be, you know, microphones or audio compressors. That was his hobby. But, you know, his day job was, you know, he worked for the Department of Energy, putting together enormously scary technology. That was what his day job was. And so to de-stress, Grandpa would come home and, yeah, he'd work on microphones and audio compressors. He had a very good friend who ran a recording studio. And this gentleman that ran the recording studio was also, at least part-time, was Dolly Parton's road engineer.
Okay.
So he was around the music industry. And so the studio engineer figured out that my grandfather, who was a scientist and electrical engineer, was pretty good with a soldering gun. So Grandpa got all the repairs by default. And so because of that, I was around all these things, and, mm-hmm. and I learned about capacitance, and I learned about, you know, transducers, and I learned about theories of electronics and recording. Mm-hmm. And then my father being a music teacher, you know, I was really around instrumental performance. But I can't talk about my father and not mention my mother, who was she was an art teacher. She graduated with an art education degree.
Okay.
And she made sure that I knew about Renoir and Monet and learned about color theory and
yep.
composition. So I was very at home looking at visual things,
mm-hmm.
As well as looking at musical things and electronic things.
Yeah.
And so if you take the triumvirate that is, and to see that I ended up in video games, it's probably not all that surprising now.
Because,
you know, because I have a screen, I have instruments, and I have lots of technology
mm-hmm.
around me. But that said, you know, it seems like the technology is at a point now where someone who wants to create a symphony doesn't have to wait around for a major orchestra to perform that symphony. They can literally get out the Walter Piston orchestration book or the Beethoven anthologies mm-hmm. and they can start experimenting with a virtual orchestra and learn orchestration on their own for
yes.
the most part. It is possible now, and a lot of trial and error, but, you know, what makes a great pilot a lot of times is flight time. And I feel like composers now have the opportunity to be in the cockpit and to fly those hours and to really take advantage of something that Mozart and Beethoven and Bach only would have dreamed of. If they could have been exposed to it. I really think that because of this, by doing The Northerner as a Kickstarter project, it really raises awareness for the arts, but not just for the arts, but for young people in the arts.
Yes.
And now we have this dynamite opportunity where we have these virtual orchestras and we have these tools and we have a lot of young people mm-hmm. and if The Northerner can inspire them to make their own symphony, you know, to go, you know, this direction. In fact, I've seen more Kickstarter symphonies crop up since I launched mine.
Oh, good.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if that's what it does and that's the net result, then that's the discussion that I wanted to start. The dialogue, if you will. And again, Kickstarter is about a dialogue. It helps to have the funding that comes in because people do contribute and and whatnot. But I think that itself is superseded really by the communication, that the benefits of going with a crowdsourcing or crowdfunding option like this. It's great for me, too, because a lot of times I'm under a non-disclosure agreement. I can't talk about a lot of the projects that I work on. And,
right.
And for the most part, you know, with these big video game projects, is, you know, they're getting upwards of $100 million or more per project. You know, they are very conscientious about who does what and who says what and what interviews are made. And I don't know. I always have the opportunity to just talk freely about what I'm doing.
Right.
And,
right.
And so here we have this opportunity, you know, for me to really have a conversation with the whole world. And I will say that, you know, the amount of Facebook messages and email messages, it's increased for me probably 100-fold. So it does take a lot of time. But on the other hand, I look at it this way. I'm swapping one thing for another. You know, normally when I'm working on a video game project, I'll be in a conference room and we'll be having creative meetings and creative discussions, and that takes a fair amount of time. And it's something I love to do it, and it's something that's very necessary for the job. But now my boardroom or my conference room are my bosses with this Kickstarter, you know, because I feel like I'm working for everyone, you know, and I want to hear from people. I want to, you know, have these conversations. And, you know, the number one conversation that seems to come up a lot is that, oh, I'm so glad, Jeremy, you're doing this because, you know, I've been discouraged and, you know, I didn't know what to do with my music and I didn't know, if this would be the right path to take in my life. You know, so you get a lot of life questions. And music's like that because I think music is... You know, there's love, and then there's music, and then there's, you know, happiness, and it's music is one of these major life factors.
Yes.
It's so close to everyone's heart, and, you know, I think there are people out there that don't like chocolate, but I haven't met anyone that doesn't like music. Each man his own. I mean, some people like, you know, death metal music. Other people might like hip hop. Some people might like classical. And for me, I think all this music is valid as long as it moves at least one person.
Us through this communication that you've mentioned a couple of times, through the Kickstarter campaign, being more connected with your listeners and your fans. And you posed a question to us early in the process about what it means to be a Northerner. This is something that, for those of us who live in Minnesota, we kind of have a pretty good idea on how to answer that question, but you've gotten a lot of responses about that. Can you speak to any that stood out to you or that surprised you, or did you expect the things you heard?
I didn't. You know, I mean, I didn't really know what to expect. You know, the one thing I found is a lot of people picked up on metaphor, and a lot of people associate going north with going home. And that was surprising to me because I had people in Bolivia telling me that going north is going home.
Oh, you know? Interesting. Sure. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I wanted to know I really want to know what are the collective impressions? What is on everyone's mind when they think of a large subject like this, because what does it mean to see Aurora Borealis? You know, or what does it mean to see a meteor shower? Or what does it mean to see ice-capped mountains? Or these are questions that, you know, I really wanted to know. I mean, I wanted to know the questions and the answers. So I think some of the stuff that really stood out to me was some of the photos people would send. I had a couple in Germany send me pictures of the Black Forest, and some folks up in Norway sent me some photos of their homeland. They said I should record up there. You know, and then people in South America sending me pictures of the Andes. And
wow.
And so it was quite interesting to see the human dynamic of a subject matter that's so open and so free, where we can really paint our own stories into this.
Speaking of stories, your music, though, often kind of tells its own tale. And in the classical world, we call that program music. Well, I guess then it would have a program along with it. But can you explain a little bit about what that means? And do you think the Northerner is going to end up kind of programmatic in and of itself?
Yeah, I think Richard Strauss wrote programmatic.
He sure did. Yes,
music.
He did.
He hurled lightning bolts at the audience. So, you know, the thing I will say is, if it brings the notion of pictures and colors, and if that's what brings people to the concert hall so they can experience music, you know, I'm fine with that. I mean, you know, I loved Pines of Rome.
Yeah.
You know, these are some great landmarks, you know, and, you know, some people made the differentiation between pure music and programmatic music. And
yes.
Brahms would be considered more of a pure music composer, and Wagner was more of a programmatic composer. And I think for me, I love the notion that people have some canvas to work with and they can paint their own picture.
Some of your favorite composers? Who inspires you the most?
Well, you know, I think Bach was almost beyond human, what he was able to do. I mean, you really wonder if he came in on a spaceship.
Yeah.
He was extraordinary. And every time I hear Bach, it's funny, you know, maybe I should categorize this a little bit. With Bach, I really didn't hear, even though it was probably there, I didn't really hear the fingerprints of a composer. It was almost like the work was so incredibly beautiful and perfect. It's almost like it sort of elevated, you know, the listener to a place where you're almost feeling that the music is beyond humanity.
Yes. You know,
it's coming right from nature itself. And with Beethoven, I think he took humanity and lifted it to the highest level.
Yes.
I never felt like...
Which is what he wanted to do.
Right. I never felt like Beethoven left us and went into orbit like Bach did. I feel like Beethoven picked us up and we flew with him. And I always feel the hand of the master. And it's not a lesser work or a greater work in any sense than Bach. But it's more human to me. And Beethoven really is probably one of my biggest influences. Mozart, I love Mozart. The thing about Mozart, though, is, and I, just as a musical linguist and what I listen to Mozart, I hear a lot of conflict in his music. And for me, just personally, and this is no offense to people who love Mozart, but his music will give me nightmares. You know, it really does. And, you know, you can hear this wonderful piano concerto in C or the clarinet concerto. And you're thinking, what? How serene and how tranquil. But, you know, underneath all of that, I don't want to say it's a facade, but underneath all of that is a darkness of what he was going through in his life. And I don't know if it's a different energy of Beethoven's. I don't know if it strikes me that Mozart may not have been the optimist in humanity that Beethoven was.
Yeah.
But they both wrote something that elevated us. And so, you know, I could say Mozart, latter Mozart maybe, would be work that I really appreciate. And, you know, the thing about Mozart, he always has to have a way to end a phrase. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So, you know, I mean, there's something about Mozart. He's the one that does that the most. He has the gigantic period or comma.
Yeah.
And it's like, all right, royalty, here's the end of the phrase, you know. And I don't hear that so much with the other composers. So definitely Beethoven is one of my more favorite composers. You know, commercially, I've had to study Wagner because, you know, Wagner is, you know, he's made a lot of money in the movie business.
Yes, he has.
Albeit he doesn't get the checks, but he's made money for everybody else. You know, and I think growing up, you know, Danny Elfman's work with Batman was, you know, the first Batman film and hearing that cuivre and the horns. And I could say my younger work, I definitely wrote more aggressively in brass and that sort of thing. And I think an interview like this would be incomplete unless I mentioned John Williams, you know, because I think John Williams has influenced nearly everyone. And
yes,
I love John's work. I think he's, you know, for all practical purposes, I mean, he's the most accomplished and greatest composer we have alive today. He's not recognized as much for his concert hall works, and he has written some important works. I mean, I love his bassoon concerto, for instance.
Yes.
But people know him for his movie music, and I'm not one that's overly concerned with my legacy, and I don't think John is either, to be honest with you. But it just seemed like now that I'm in my latter 30s, I really needed to start thinking about what am I doing for the concert hall? And wanted to make sure that I'm not starting it too late. And that's one of the things that came into my mind with the symphony. It was like, well, do I want to do a piano concerto first? Do I want to start with a clarinet concerto? Or how about, why don't we just do a sinfonietta? Or why don't we do an operetta? You know, something, so anything other than the symphony. And you know what? I said, you know, at this point, I've got to do number one. I've got to get that started. You know, and like I said, I may not make it to 9, but I for sure won't get to 9 unless I get 1 going.
Why did you decide to do a choral symphony?
The human voice to me is the most powerful instrument on earth. It really is almost matched by the violin, by stringed instruments, because of the amount of expression.
Yes.
And that's coming from a trombone player, so sorry guys, I like brass too. But I really feel like there's a message there in voice, and that's why I want to involve singers. And, you know, I've had a great experience in the past working with choirs. And of course, people here have heard my work in the video games. And I also had an opportunity a number of years ago to compose a work for the L.A. Master Chorale and to have a world premiere there with Frank Gehry sitting nearby, who designed the Disney Hall. I was tasked with closing the first half of the concert. and we got a standing ovation. And I wrote this tone poem called Lex Stas, which is based on the text of Victor Hugo. And that's what really got my feet wet with writing for the concert hall and choir and orchestra.
One of the things, it's it's hard for me to not get all fangirl on you sometimes.
That's right.
But, one of the things that I appreciate about your music quite a bit is something that we actually touched on briefly not that long ago in this very conversation, but you slip between major and minor just quite seamlessly at times. Sometimes it's in a cadence, like you'll do like a major one to a minor four and back or something like that. But sometimes it's more of an overarching harmonic shift, and I'll be listening and I'll be in this major happy place, and then we just kind of slip for a moment into minor. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that a conscious thing that you do, or am I just picking up on an anomaly?
No, it's I'm everything I do is tightly controlled. That's one thing I have control over is composition. There's a whole bunch of things like deadlines I don't have control over, but no, I'm looking for color saturation. Mm-hmm. To kind of use, you know, some photography terms. You know, sometimes I'm looking to saturate, sometimes I'm looking to desaturate.
Yes.
I feel like, you know, there's different sets of symmetry that I work with, and you know, I could go down and talk for hours about this, but really the simplest way to describe what I do is I'm looking for balance. So if I'm going along and everything's pretty major for a while,
yeah,
I don't want that to become solidified. I want to undulate a little bit, and, and I want to keep the sense of progression going. And so maybe I'm in a more of a happier key or a major key. I want to balance it out with maybe a little bit of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Then I'll start shifting, or I'll start you know, going into a relative major versus or a minor, or I might transpose, might shift chromatically. Mm-hmm. It depends on a lot of the formulas intuitively that I'm working with. But you know, I started composition out, you know, at a very young age. And really, to me, the way I learned how to compose was through ear training. Mm-hmm. So I would listen to a C and a D, like a whole step interval, anywhere on the keyboard.
Sure.
And I would try to understand what that meant. A much more pinched sound is the sound of a minor second, which is basically if you're on a piano and you play a white key and a black key that are right next to each other, that's going to be a minor second. And that's kind of an unpleasing sound. Mm-hmm. But that's when I learned about the value of dissonance versus the value of harmony. Mm-hmm. And kind of understanding what these building blocks of sound were in little bits and pieces. And so the way I construct harmony is very elemental. I work with the smallest values all the way up to the largest, most complex values. And while keeping that sort of in my mind, I'm also looking at the rhythmic symmetries. So if you have something that kind of plods along, you might want to stop plodding for a while and rest. You know, that might be something that happens. Or if you have something that really clips along and it has a lot of repetition of harmonies and whatnot, then you might want to modulate more, because you need some variation to happen in the midst of repetitive rhythm.
Yes.
Music is all about balance, as I said before. And so if some factor is weighing in, then I'm going to try to find a counterbalance to that. And I want the music to be moving forward at all times. I don't want it to be, as they say, dead center. I don't want it to be so balanced that it doesn't move.
Yeah.
It really has to move with the symmetry in mind. course, people have said that classical music is dying. They've said that for years. And
yep.
The reality is it'll never die.
Correct.
Because
yeah.
You know, the creations are transcendent. And,
yeah.
You know, you have waxes and wanes of popularity of certain composers. And, you know, but what's there is valid, which is why the Louvre is valid. It's why the Getty Center is valid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Metropolitan Museum of Art is valid. And you have the human achievement that's involved in classical music is something that is always going to be there. We're always going to hear it.
Yep.
There's really no mystery to it. I mean, if someone wants to make music, it's just time and love, really. If you put those two elements together and you're dedicated to it, you will accomplish what you want in music, and that is priceless.
Jeremy, you have currently 2,493 backers. I would imagine it'll be more than 2,500 by the time this posts on Monday, and I just wish you the best of luck with this project. I have high hopes for it in so many ways. I think a lot of good things can come from this. So congratulations on what's been raised so far, and best of luck to reach your stretch goal.
Thanks, Emily, and I also want to thank all the Northerners out there, because when you contribute, or even if you can't financially contribute, if you just support the symphony, you're a Northerner, as far as I'm concerned. You're in the club.
You've been listening to Top Score from Classical Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Emily Reese, and I had help this week from Johnny Vince Evans. I also had help from my good friend, Dr. Brendan McGlynn. You can find more information about Jeremy's Kickstarter project on classicalmpr.org/topscore. That's MPR, right? So classicalmpr.org/topscore. Upcoming episodes of Top Score feature Kevin Ripple from Aliens Colonial Marines. Awesome score. Jason Graves from Tomb Raider, of course, amazing score too. And I think there's going to be a Borderlands 2 episode, and that would be Jesper Kidd, Chris Velasco, and Sasha Dikitsian. Great game, great score. You can follow Top Score on Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook at Top Score Podcast. You can learn more about Top Score and me at classicalmpr.org/topscore. And there's also a spot to leave me comments or questions at that site.